I'm Rupert Guinness, and with me is Aaron S. Lee over in the United States. I'm in not so sunny Sydney, but we're on the verge of St. Patrick's Day. This is our St. Patrick's Day special. You're listening to What a Ride, which is the show about swim, bike, and run, and any other sport that tickles your fancy. And we're recording for Radio Sydney FM for Australian Broadcasting Media. And I've got with me on the line for another crackerjack issue, Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing over there in New Orleans?
G'day, Rube. I'm doing fantastic, mate. As you said, I'm getting ready for St. Patrick's Day while you're about to partake.
That's right, my friend. I'm going to a lunch at Luna Park for the Lansdowne Club, which is an Irish businessmen's association. I went to the lunch last year, and as you can imagine, it all starts with Guinness. It continues with Guinness, and it finishes with Guinness. And being a Guinness, I've got to be in the right attire. I've got my Guinness tie already ironed, ready to put on. I don't often wear a tie these days, but this is a very special day, so why not? What about for yourself, Aaron? What have you got planned for the big occasion?
Well, I'm going to probably start early since you're going to be celebrating today. Obviously, you are a day ahead. I don't want to be left behind, so I may go to one of my favorite local haunts, which is only about 2 blocks away. It's a little place called Molly's Market, and it's been around forever. It's on the lower French Quarter on Decatur Street, and it's a bit of an Irish pub. The owner is actually passed away, but he's still there in spirit in a lot of ways. He's in an urn behind the bar on a mantle, along with a few of the top patrons that have frequented Molly's over the years that are no longer with us. But it's a great Irish place. It's a famous spot here in New Orleans for the local media. It's been kind of a media pub for a few decades now, and it's a good chance to go over there and catch up with some friends who are fellow journalists, both in print, radio, and television. So looking forward to seeing some of those guys today, but then tomorrow for St. Patrick's Day, we'd probably partake in some of the St. Patrick's Day parades in our famed Irish Channel, the Irish section of New Orleans. Well, it's not all French, Rupe. It's not all French.
Well, look, my friend, I'm sure amidst all that banter, that Irish banter, there'll be talk about sport. And that's what we're also here for on What a Ride. And coming up this weekend is the first of the five monuments of world cycling. The first of the five major one-day classics, Milan-San Remo. Not in Ireland, but in Italy. So a lot of talk has been happening, Aaron, about Milan-San Remo this year. We've had all the, it seems for it like a lifetime and a day since this season began back in Australia. But we've the season's come through Australia, through Asia, through the Middle East, and now it's in Europe. And we've just seen the last final lead-up races to Milan-San Remo, Paris-Nice, and also Tirreno-Adriatico. It's a really exciting race, Aaron. I love Milan-San Remo, because this is when you really feel that the season's starting. And, you know, I'm pretty excited about this year's race. I don't know, how do you feel about Milan-San Remo? I know you're a long way there. Actually, you're probably closer to Milan-San Remo than I am.
Yeah, I probably am, Rupe. But I tell you, when you think about length and distance, that's a perfect analogy when we're talking about Milan-San Remo. At 298 kilometers, nearly 300 kilometers, that's a long day in the saddle, buddy.
It certainly is. It's and it's a long day in the media car too, because you have to drive all those kilometres down. I know that the years I've covered it, actually it's not too hard. It's not. You can find a nice little spot and have a little bit of pasta for lunch, and then you get down to San Remo and wait for the big race to hurtle into town. Well, we're going to speak about that. We're also going to, in the show, we're going to have a special interview with a guy who has won Milan-San Remo, but he will not be racing it this year, but Australia's Matt Goster, to check in to see what he's doing with his career, where that's tracking with the One Pro cycling team, the British team, which first raced at the Tour de Langkawi. We're also going to have a bit of a chat with a famous former cyclist, Graham Jones, who was one of the early pioneers of the ACBB amateur French team that became the funnel for talent to the old Peugeot team, where guys like Stephen Roach, Phil Anderson, and those guys raced with. Graham's going to speak to us about how he saw the season so far, and also where he sees the season going. And he's going to have a little bit of a flashback as well about the old days. We like the good old days, you know, when men were men, not like today, when everything was so easy. Only just kidding there, if you're listening there. And then, Aaron, also I think we're going to have a bit of a chat, aren't we, about what's happening over in New Orleans. I know there's been a bit of flooding going on, and there's been this the bike race, the Rougerie-Roubaix. So I'm looking forward to hearing about all that happening, because it does sounds more than just a bike race.
Absolutely. Look forward to catching up after the break, Rube.
Okay, well, look, let's get into gear. Let's get on the saddle. Let's get our feed bags ready and take a little break first, and we'll come back after this piece of music for What a Ride. Again, another great selection from Aaron for that piece of music. Always gets you into the mood. And what the mood we want to be in is for Milan San Remo, as we said, is the first of the five monuments of world cycling. Just for the record, the other five monuments, the other monuments of those five are the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and then at the tail end of the season, the Giro di Lombardia in Italy. But anyway, we're here to talk about Milan-San Remo, and we're just talking a little bit earlier about what makes Milan-San Remo so special. It's called the Primavera, which is the beginning of the spring. So you've got that sort of lead into the spring, and the first major classic. As Aaron said before the break, you know, it's 298 kilometres. That's a long, long way. And when you include the neutral zone before and inevitably a couple of kilometres you have to ride afterwards, a lot of the riders end up getting 300 kilometres plus in their legs. And also there's the unpredictability. The course is so long and you've got this big build-up toward the crescendo of the race as the race comes down from Milan and it hits the coast and then it comes along the coast where there's all the climbs, the hills. And one by one, the riders tend to drop off. And when you get to the final climb, the Poggio, which starts with about 7 kilometres to go, that's when the race really explodes. And there's this big fight and this big elbows are out for everybody to try and get the top position, in the front position of the peloton. By then, it's usually pretty small at the top of the Poggio for this fantastic course crew descent down to the finish into San Remo and then the race. It is. When I just talk about it, I get excited, Aaron. You may not be excited about how I'm talking, Aaron, but what gets you excited about Milan-San Remo?
Well, I'll tell you, it's just the fact that, as you said, it really just kicks off the spring, doesn't it? As one of the classics, as one of the five monuments of cycling, this is a truly, we use the word iconic a lot of times in media, but it really is an iconic road race. And when you look back at the history of the event, which dates back to the early 1900s, one name is really synonymous with the race, which is seven-time champion, the great Belgian Eddie Merckx. And for the ones who are our listeners who are in Australia who are listening to the show, they're going to think 2011, 2012, names like Matthew Goss or Simon Gerrans. But even last year, Michael Matthews of Orca Green Edge Bling, who finished third on the podium, who's already shown some form already this last week at Paris-Nice. There's just a lot to be excited about in this fantastic race.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things I find kind of strange about the race is, by the time we've seen all these races, you get your list of favourites or candidates for the race, and even though you can see why they could be candidates or should be candidates, there's still this unpredictability. You know, I was reading an article with Mark Cavendish, who obviously, he won it in 2009, just beating Australia's Heinrich Hausler, but he was talking about how unpredictable everything is. You just don't know until those last kilometres, and it is true. But I think, some of the names we're looking at this year, I mean, Cav, he's obviously a guy we will... there is unpredictability about Cavendish because he's just come off the track program, and he was saying it the other day that he's not quite sure of his form, but I still would never discount Cavendish. But they've got a really good team at Dimension Data, with Edvald Boasenhagen, who's going really well. I'm kind of excited to see, I haven't seen the full start list, but if their South African rider, Reinhard Jans van Rensburg, who won the Tour de Langkawi, if he is in the team, he could be a really strong asset for Cavendish and or Boasenhagen in the finale. Other names obviously you think of it as Christoph, who's going well. Peter Sagan, he's getting closer to that elusive first season win. Apparently he's shaving his legs now, so he must be ready. He hadn't shaved them for like a good part of 6 or 7 weeks of the season. And then obviously from Orica Green Edge, obviously you wouldn't discount Gerrans, Aaron, as you said before, but I'd have to say the big favourite is, as you mentioned his name, Michael Matthews, who's rode superbly in Paris-Nice.
Well, he really is, Rupe. And, this is an exciting time. And I think this could be a breakout season for Michael Matthews. Again, a little bit of controversy swept in that stage win that he had at Paris-Nice. A little bit of argy-bargy, not on Michael Matthews' behalf, but he was a beneficiary of an official call. But, Michael, he's... think he's got all the skills. He has all the talent. I think this year he's going to put it all together. I think there's a lot of confidence and a lot that he learned this past year, especially at the World Championships. And after, you know, overcoming and I think we're going to see a more mature, a grounded, a more confident Michael Matthews as the weeks and the months progress this season. You know, you mentioned something a while ago about 2009 and Mark Cavendish, and I keep going back to that. You talked about him just barely edging out Henrik Hassler, which by a millimeter almost, Rube, is kind of known as the millimeter sprint win. But Henrik never was quite the same after that race. So as much as Milan Sanremo has made careers, and in retrospect, it put a dampening on Heinrich's career. Of course, Heinrich came back last year and surprised everyone with a sensational ride and running on to win the Australian Road Nationals. But still, Heinrich was never quite the same. Perhaps he may have lost a little bit of confidence, lost his edge after that race. Do you recall that year, 2009, that race?
I do recall the race in 2009, Aaron. I thought it was a gripping finale, but I felt for Heinrich Hassler, as you're saying, you know, how much can that scar him or not to lose like that? And, you know, because, as you said, it's a make or break, and how does it break? I wouldn't say it broke his career, because he had a very good season that year. He did finish, you know, fourth in Paris-Roubaix, and well, I think it was fourth, certainly top 10 anyway, but in fourth in the Tour of Flanders as well. So he was certainly consistent and on form, but then again, they were near miss results as well. But we've seen, as you said, Aaron, he's won, you know, his Tour de France stage, he's won the great national championship last year, and so he can come up with great rides. It's just the consistency, and not just in a season, but he needs seasons to be consistent, and I just hope he does sort of kick into gear there. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, former, well, I guess he wasn't a Milan San Remo winner, Heinrich, but one who was a former Milan San Remo winner is Matt Goss. You mentioned him before, and he's not going to be there this year, but there's going to be a very interesting season ahead of him for as he rides for the One Pro team from Britain. I saw him at the Tour de Langkawi, and I had a bit of a chat to Matt Goss, but let's just take a little bit of a break first, get our breath back together, and then we'll have a chat to Matt Goss to see what he thinks about where his career is going and how he fits into the One Project, a One Pro cycling team from Britain. Talking with Matt Goss at the start of the fourth stage of the Tour de Langkawi in the city of Ipoh. Matt, you've joined another new team. One Pro Cycling, a British team which has a lot of grand ambitions. Can you sort of explain how the move from MTN Quebec / now Dimension Data to One Pro Cycling came about and why?
Well, it kind of came about, we were talking with a couple of different people and talking with a couple of different teams, and I kind of like the idea that, you know, Matt Pryor, he comes from a bit of a different background. You know, I think you've seen a sport, a lot of teams, you know, it's a rider who's become a director, who's then gone on to be a manager, and they've got the same mentalities in the same ways. And, you know, Matt has a lot of different ideas with One Pro Cycling. You know, he's obviously been a professional sportsman at a top level, but he hasn't had the same things spoken to him, you know, over the last 30 years, which a lot of other teams and, you know, other people have done. So it's quite a refreshing take on a team, you know. Everything's done in a very professional way, but, you know, there's some different ideas involved in the team. I quite like that. It's quite exciting. It's come a long way in the last, you know, year and a half that the team's been around. So, and they're aiming to go a lot further into the future. So it's quite an exciting project and something I'm, you know, excited to be part of.
It's interesting because we saw the former Formula One champion Alonso try and get a team up and going. That didn't work. As you said, Matt Pryor, former English cricketer. What sort of thinking does he have that's sort of different that you believe helped him to get the team up and going, whereas Alonso wasn't able to do that?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know the full ins and outs of everything that Alonso was trying to do, but you know, he's also trying to balance a Formula One career at the same time. So I don't know how much time he has to actually really get on the ground and get the thing up and running himself. You know, he's obviously got a lot of people that are doing it for him. Where, you know, Matt Pryor, he's retired from cricket now, and this is his new thing. You know, he lives and breathes this team, so that's what he's doing. You know, basically 24 hours a day. So I think that's a big difference there. You know, he's very driven in what he's doing here, and like I said, he's probably got a lot more time to spend on it than somebody like Alonso, who's you know, doing 300k an hour around a track somewhere.
Yeah, I should stand correct. I probably dissed Alonso there, called him Formula One champion. You'd probably argue with me on that one. Listen, for you, Matt, this move, though, I mean, this is, you know, you had HTC High Road, Orica Green Edge, you're a foundation member of, and then MTN Quebec, now Dimension Data. This is, what, your fourth or fifth team now. Do you feel, is it hard to make changes, or is it, you have to keep an open mind?
Sometimes it's hard to make changes, but, you know, this one's been very easy. The guys in the team have been awesome. The staff's awesome. It's super organised. One of the most organised teams I've been part of. So that's quite refreshing, you know, that makes the process a lot easier. And, you know, it's still a learning curve. You know, we've been racing. Some of these guys are still their first race, and it's my first race with... It's going to be my first race with guys at most races I go to. So you're still going to be learning how each other ride. You're still going to learn how to get the best out of each other. But it's something that, you know, we've got a great atmosphere in the team. And when you've got a great atmosphere and everyone's happy working together, then it doesn't take long to learn how to get the best out of each other. And, you know, I think we're doing that already. You know, we can see we've been in the front most races we've been to.
Now, you're a rider with a lot of experience. With this new team and for this season coming up, what sort of real personal goals do you have for yourself? I mean, I guess it's no secret, it's been a little while, it's been a bit lean on wins for you in the last few years, and I know you hate me asking that all the time, but I mean, do you still have that burning desire and belief that a major win, if not more, is in with those legs there?
Oh, I've got to, otherwise it's too hard to get on the bike every day, isn't it? So, yeah, well, I have got a lot of experience, so that's one of the things that the team definitely want me for is, you know, my knowledge and experience of the racing. And you know, I'm not that old. I'm kind of getting there now, but I've been around for a long time. It's my 10th year pro, so, you know, I've got a lot to give to a team, you know, that's growing and, you know, wanting to learn. And, you know, I still think that there's a race win or two in the legs. I've just got to, you know, take the opportunities when they come and try and make the most of them.
Must be the beard you're wearing that makes you look older. Yeah. With this year, obviously, One Pro Cycling are not doing a Grand Tour, but you still have some interesting, you know, interesting program up there. What can you sort of go through the program briefly and highlight what are some of the major races that the team's targeting?
Yeah, look, we've got some great races. Obviously, for the team being One Pro and an English team, the emphasis is going to be on a lot of the English races. You know, we've toured Yorkshire and Tour of Britain, and these races are obviously big targets for the team. So, you know, we'll focus on them. But we have got some great racing. You know, go back to Belgium. We've got a couple of races back there next weekend, the weekend after, and then Criterium International. So it's all top quality racing, and you know, racing that some of the races which I haven't done before, but I've always wanted to. So it's quite a nice change. You know, I never got to come to Malaysia before, but I've had the opportunity to come here now, and even, you know, with Dubai a fortnight ago, so that was quite cool as well. So we've got some good racing, we've got a great program, and you know, being a first year pro continental team racers want to see something of the team before they hand out these wildcard invites, and you know, we've got to prove to these races that we deserve a spot to be there, and you know, the race program's growing all the time, and we've just got to keep working on that.
Well, Matt, thanks very much for talking to us, and all the best. I'm sure One Pro Cycling will make a huge impact this year, and wish you all the very best.
Thanks very much. I try to discover a little something to make me sweeter. Oh, baby, refrain from breaking my heart. I'm so in love with you. I'll be forever blue. That you give me no reason why you make me work so hard. That you give me no, that you give me no, that you give me no, that you give me no soul. I hear you calling, oh baby, please.
And Aaron S. Lee. Well, we've just heard all the goss, literally, from Matt Goss. He's always a good talker, Matt, and I mean that with total respect. As I said, I thought that sounded bad, didn't it? He is a good. He's always been available to the media, and he's never shied away from talking. And you know, his career has been a bit of a topsy-turvy career. It's been a number of years now since he's actually won a race, and I always feel kind of awkward having. You know, I guess it's the question you have to keep asking him. You know, when will he win his next race, or how does he feel about that sort of drought of wins? And you know what, he still fronts up and asks it. He does have a bit of a wry smile on it when you do ask him, but he's a professional and he will always give time, so I've got time for him. Aaron, how did you feel about Matt?
Your heart has to go out to a guy like Matty Goss, because he is such a lovable bloke, isn't he? When I think of Matt Goss, I go back to three years ago, his final season at Orica Green Edge. And I remember sitting down with him for about 30 minutes there at the winery ride, there at the Mitchelton Winery, the team presentations that Orica Green Edge is famous for there in Victoria. And I remember sitting down with him, and we had a great chat. And there was something missing from Matt's eyes. It was something completely different than I'd seen 2 years earlier. In chatting with him in an interview in Sydney. And I remember it just seemed like there was a little bit of, we talked about Heinrich Hausler perhaps losing a bit of confidence over the years, but I felt that Gossie had also lost a little bit of confidence. And I'm curious as to, you have seen him since then, obviously. Of course, he went on and rode a season with Quebeca, which is now Dimension Data. But you had a chance to see him in Langkawi. Where was it at? Did he have that sparkle? Did he have that gleam in his eye?
Well, I think he was. It was hard to, well, it was curious. I was curious because because it was his first race back, really, and he hadn't raced in Malaysia before. And you know, he got as close as, you know, he got into a ninth place on the last day there in a bunch sprint. Another day he was well positioned, but there was a crash right in front of him. You know, I think he's still finding his way a bit. You know, with a new team as well. And I know that, you know, while we spoke about, you know, the classics and stuff and what he would be doing, and he was saying how he's, you know, he's, I guess his team, because it is a pro continental team, their main goals are going to be over in Britain, you know, like the Tour de Yorkshire and all that sort of stuff. And I know deep down he'd love to be doing Grand Tours and major classics. But I guess he is excited about where one pro cycling can go. There is talk that they want to become world tour, and they are certainly for a continental team. They look like a pretty slick, well organised team as well. So I just hope he gets back into the groove of winning. I think that's what he needs to do. Like, it's been a number of years now that he's won a race. He did ride for. It was interesting to hear when he says that one of his, you know, great pleasures was riding in that winning team time trial for Orica Green Edge, the Tour de France. But for an individual win, you're going back several years now, and he needs that breakthrough, and he needs to get that confidence back again, I think, Aaron.
Well, you know, it's his third team in as many years. That can't be good on the confidence. I think of Matty Goss. I also think of another Australian who perhaps maybe underachieved as well, even though his performances were quite impressive, and Alan Davis. Do you see that at all, Ruth?
Yeah, there's similarity there too as well. I think with what sets Matt Goss aside is there was a lot of publicity about, it was quite open in the public that he was the highest paid rider. He was the marquee name on Orica Green Edge when they started. I guess as he wasn't winning as many races as the team had expected or hoped, that pressure built on Matt as well. And it is a lot of pressure to carry, but I guess it's easy to say, well, you're getting paid for it, so you should do it. But I think it just shows, no matter how much you're getting paid, that doesn't make it easier to win a race, you know. And these little things start with whispers. They start with, you know, someone's sort of sense of frustration, because you could be a teammate or a couple of teammates, but you start to see it in their eyes that they're frustrated. Then you start to cramp up emotionally, and you're unable to sort of produce your best natural race like that, I think. And I think that really had a lot to do with Matt Goss. So maybe racing in a continental team this year, okay, Quebeca were, MTN Quebeca, now Dimension Data, they were continental last year as well. So, but maybe this year, you know, with a bit of a more modest program, and there'll be less limelight on him than there was at MTN Quebec, because there was a lot of attention on that South African team last year. Maybe now he'll be a bit less pressured, and he can just get back into the groove of winning, you know, and take a, not think about what races am I at and all that sort of stuff. Just get back to winning.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's easy with a sport like cycling, because there is a bike component to the sport itself, that we sometimes forget that, that the other 50% of that quotient is obviously the rider, which is a human being. And of course, as human beings, we are flawed, and more important, we are subjected to mental and emotional stresses.
That's right, that's right. Hey, look, I know before we were talking about Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico and the performances there, but I guess it was interesting that they, you know, they both had the issues of the poor weather affecting stages, and, you know, and the both races put into the place the protocol for bad weather, which is unfair for the riders. It was good to see, I think, that they took that initiative, although I think they still have to iron out the options for plan Bs, like what would be plan B if you do cancel a stage or whatever. I think they have to still iron out the process, but at least it shows that organisers are thinking of the well-being of the rider, which should be the priority. How did you feel about that, Aaron? I mean,
I couldn't get over the fact of just that final podium at Paris-Nice. Forget the weather. That was one of the more stellar final podiums you'd have in any race anywhere in the world, especially with the element of two former Sky teammates being on there. I thought it was fantastic racing. And being someone who's in the deep south of New Orleans, I like seeing a bit of snow, mate. I like seeing cycling get down and dirty, because these guys are tough. You know, we laugh about football. There's the memes on Facebook and social media about, you know, soccer and the guys feigning injury and maybe carrying on a bit. Pro cyclists are not that at all. They're the toughest, some of the toughest, arguably some of the toughest athletes in the world. And it was good to see them get a little cold, get a little gritty, but obviously not to the expense of their safety, for sure. But I think the Rays handled it quite well. It ended up being a fantastic week of racing. And again, that final podium with Geraint Thomas and, of course, Alberto Contador and Richie Porte. You've had a chance to see two of those three up close this year, earlier in the season for sure. What did you make of the final?
Oh, look, I thought those last 2 days of racing were absolutely exceptional. And, you know, one set the other up. You know, I mean, you had the second last stage, you know, and that was an absolute cracker of a stage. But then on the last stage, with Contador attacking like he did, I mean, gosh, he impresses me with his attitude to racing. He is, you talk about people who are born to race, and he is a racer, you know, through heart and soul and his body, you know. And he just threw down the gauntlet, and okay, it didn't pay off for him, but I mean, gee, I think it did pay off for him, really, because I think he earned so much more respect amongst, not just within the peloton, but around the world of cycling, to see him race like that. And this is his last year, and you know, he got second place overall, 4 seconds shy of the win. And how I've got to say, Richie Porte, you know, I'm really pleased with how he's tracking with his view towards the Tour de France. You know, he's won this race the last 2 years. Okay, he got third this year, so it shows his form still going very well. Well, when you think of the caliber of riders, who are the two riders who are above him, and it shows he's, you know, like this time last year, he was at his peak. He's not at his peak yet. So I think he's showing signs of maturity, and he's getting his confidence back that he's still in the fray there, you know. And he was able to go with Contador on that last attack as they went over the Col d'Huez. But then, What a guy, a rider, Geraint Thomas, to chase back like that, and the Sky team to ride like that. I mean, that was an absolute brilliant, brilliant bike racing, Aaron. I'd say it was one of the best bike races I've seen, you know, that, particularly that last day.
Oh, I agree completely. Rube, you're spot on. I'll tell you, the only thing, I sit there and think about Torino, the race that was going on as well, and I was looking at the 30-year-old Greg Van Avermaet from VMC, and seeing what a stellar year he's having after having a great success last year with podiums top fives and some podiums there at Flanders, at Paris-Roubaix, and then, of course, the AMSL Gold Race. But then this year, with a podium at the Tour of Qatar, a win in Omloops 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, and then what a stellar performance at Tirreno.
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, it was a shame that I know we're talking about how the you know, with the bad weather and everything, how that you know, the organisers have to sort of think of the riders' safety first. But it did in Torino lead to the main mountain stage being cut out, and we saw the comments from Vincenzo Nibali, who was saying, "I might not even come and do the Giro now because of this." You know, I guess he had a bit of a hissy fit, really, which created a bit of polemics in the peloton. Certain riders suggested that he should go home and. Rather than come to a bike race, then complain, because these measures, protocol measures, were put in place for the well-being of riders, not to sort of, not to cheat them of opportunities to win. And while it did impact the overall race, the safety was paramount. You know, if that stage was in, it's one of these if situations. If that mountain stage was in, I don't think Greg Van Avermaet would have won it. But you know what? He won it in the end of the day, and he had to fight to win it, and he had to defend that jersey in the final time trial, and that was a very, very close time trial. You know, Cancellara getting up on his to win that, and you know, to defend a jersey in that calibre of field, it takes some sort of rider. But for BMC, it's been a fantastic start to the season, hasn't it? With, as you mentioned, he won to Torino, Richie Porte getting third overall in Paris-Nice, and thanks to his second place at the Tour Down Under, the first World Tour race of the season. Now Richie's leading the World Tour rankings.
No, absolutely, and of course it couldn't happen to a better bloke, and I hope to see this. We were talking about Michael Matthews potentially having a stellar 2016. It'd be great to see Richie Porte really take it to that next level, and some of the races that he has lined up in the future, but primarily with the Tour de France on the radar. It'd be great to see Richie join those that short list of professional riders that have a Grand Tour win under their belt.
Hey, look, just before we go to the break, though, I know we've been talking everything about Euro and Euro cycling. I know over your way, Aaron, at Norlands, you've had, correct me if the right name for this race, is it the Rougerie-Roubaix? And tell us a bit.
Absolutely, Rip. It's the Rougerie-Roubaix.
Rougerie-Roubaix, I apologise.
Yeah, Rougerie-Roubaix, because obviously it's right near the state capital, Baton Rouge, which means in French, red stick. So the Rougerie-Roubaix, there's not any cobbles. It's a bit of a play off the Paris-Roubaix, of course. There's not any cobbles, but there are several gravel sections that are quite treacherous. And it made for some interesting racing. The race has been going on since 1999, I believe. It's quite popular. It is the biggest bike race in the state of Louisiana, a state of about 4 million. It's not a UCI race, but yet a lot of the U.S. registered pros come in from the continental and pro-continental teams. This year we saw young 26-year-old Arizonan Travis McCabe, who rides for the Hincapie development team, Jalisco Citadel. He and his teammates swept the podium. So they went a bit uncontested. One of the heavy pre-race favorites, Michael Olheiser, who had won the race back-to-back in 2005-2006, was here solo after his Lupus Racing team teammates who were registered to come join him, including Winston David, the rider who won it last year, were unable to make this year's trip following a tour in Dominican Republic last week. So Olheiser ended up finishing fifth with Travis taking the win. On an altered course due to some heavy rainfall and flash flooding that affected the area and the entire state with a bit of damage. The actual route and the 160-kilometer race, a 100-miler, was changed a few times in the 24 hours leading up to the race. There was even question, Rube, if the race would even happen at all. But, of course, Mother Nature turned on her charm on Sunday. You couldn't have asked for better conditions. It's sloppy, a little muddy, but the guys were ready for it. It made for one hell of a day of racing. And a young lady by the name of Lauren DeCrescenzo, from the women's team, Visit Dallas DNA Pro Cycling, one of the World Tour teams, came back and with the help of one of her teammates, she won it for the second straight year as well. So it was a great day of racing in Louisiana. It was really interesting seeing cycling done at that level here in the States. And of course, we had it all fitted up with cypress trees, Spanish moss, and old French styled plantations. And of course, we had the bluegrass and the jazz and the blues, live band, live music playing afterwards. So you just couldn't beat it for atmosphere. It was a great day to be there, bud.
Yeah, I saw some of your Facebook photos there of the signing area, and also a nice little video of the band playing, and a great atmosphere there. If you know anyone wants to look onto Aaron's Facebook, there's some beautiful shots there. You've sent some great shots back over the last 8 months, actually, of your times and travels there. But that was I had to do a bit of a double take, thinking, gosh, this is a bike race.
It really is, Rupe, and it just gives you, as you know, you just recently got back from Langkawi yourself, and it's the great thing about cycling, isn't it? Because it does just crosses boundaries and political boundaries as well, not just geographical and economic. I think that's the great thing about cycling. It brings so many different cultures together, and also opens the door to cultures for people to take just a little bit of a glimpse inside and kind of entice them. After all, that's what the sport of cycling was basically based off of 100 years ago, right, Rupe? A bit of tourism?
Yeah, exactly. Just to promote the French newspaper L'Auto. That's how the Tour de France began, and L'Auto owned that newspaper, and they decided to have a bike race. But of course, bike racing started beforehand, and as you said, it's generally to promote the area of the country they're in, the produce, the culture, the heritage, and everything. And like when I went to Langkawi, I'd never been to Malaysia before, and one of the great things about bike races, you go to places you quite probably wouldn't go to if you were just lobbing up as a tourist, because the bike races do go into the vast countryside where you just wouldn't think of being, and it was I saw the beautiful area of not all of Malaysia, but everywhere I went to it was beautiful, and the diversity surprised me as well, particularly when I got up to the Cameron Highlands, I just thought, these are places I'd love to come back to sometime, thanks to this bike race, and I wouldn't mind even coming back and bringing a bike myself. I know they have the Ironman there, the Malaysian Ironman. Man, I don't know how athletes get through that though, because geez, it's so humid, you break a sweat having a shower there.
No, you absolutely do. I know for a fact you break a sweat when you dry it off, but it is a beautiful area. And of course, I've over the last couple of years had a chance to really get to know a lot of the stops along the Asia Tour. Those guys do a lot with a little, and they should be commended on the jobs they do, from the media standpoint, from the execution of the races themselves and the logistics of it. It's great. It's great to have a race like the Tour of Langkawi in Malaysia gets behind. My only gripe is that I understand they actually did go into Langkawi this year, and for the second year in a row, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Genting was not in, the famous climb was also not in the route.
That's right. And, while the Cameron Highlands was a nice climb, everyone was saying that the Genting Highlands, that would have had a much bigger impact on the race rather than the Cameron Highlands. So, I wouldn't be surprised if they went back to the Genting Highlands next year. And maybe they would get to Langkawi next year, because it is kind of odd saying, I've been to the Tour de Langkawi, and they say, what's Langkawi like? I said, well, actually, the Tour didn't get to Langkawi. But anyway, that's one of the great things about bike races too, isn't it? It's like the old 4 days of Dunkirk, that would go for 6 days. Why is it called the 4 days of Dunkirk? You go, I don't know, just because.
Exactly. Well, it's great. Langkawi is grandfathered in, but hopefully they'll return back to the island. And for those who haven't been to Langkawi, just especially for the Australians listening on the show, it's a lot like Byron Bay.
Oh, we just saw the nude bike rally there for the... Okay. I don't suggest you go nude, though. You could have a bit of trouble, I think.
Well, I don't suggest I go nude anywhere.
Look, I think we better just leave it there. I think we better calm the temperature down a bit here. It's getting a bit hot here. I think it's time for a bit of music here, Aaron. Can you just get us into the groove? Not nude, just groove, okay? Just go into your LP record case there or whatever you've got there. Pick us a bit of music, and we'll come back after the break. This is What a Ride. You're listening to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. Well, the temperature's calmed down a little bit. It was getting a little bit hot there before the break, but Aaron has managed to get us all back to our senses with that nice bit of music. Aaron, look, we said earlier in the show that we're going to be speaking to Graham Jones, who was a great British rider. You know, he went to the ACBB amateur team in Paris, and then he went to Peugeot, which was the professional team for whom riders like Phil Anderson, Sean Yates rode for, Robert Miller rode for. They all went through the ACBB, schooling of cycling in France, and then went into the professional ranks that way. They were called the Foreign Legion. And in many ways, Graeme Jones was the pioneer of the pioneers. He went through in 1978, and he went at his time. He was touted as being going to be the next best thing for British cycling. He was a very, very good rider. But at the Tour de Langkawi, Aaron, I managed to catch up with him, have a chat. We were going to a little bit of a two-part interview here with Graham. But first off, Aaron, I mean, you've crossed paths with Graham before, haven't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, you know, it goes without question that you mentioned, you know, the ACBB, but he did have a stellar, an absolutely stellar junior career, an amateur career. And really, you can't gauge his pro career by just looking at his Palmeiras alone, Kangaroo, because he was often put in that position where he was serving as a domestique or often a super domestique to some of his teammates that weren't always a better cyclist than he was. And I think that's the thing about Graham, is that the talent was always there, but also that selfless nature. And I'm really looking forward to hearing this interview.
Yeah, well, Graham was, you know, he's always been a great guy to chat with. And, you know, at the Tour de Langkawi this year, he was doing all the calls on radio tour. So he was announcing all the breakaways and the crashes and who was in what groups and all that sort of stuff. But in this first part of the interview, which I spoke to him just before the start of the last stage, we sat down, managed to find a quiet and relatively cool area to in the shadow of a building to have a bit of a chat. And in this first part, we spoke about the Tour de Langkawi and where it's going, where it's come from, but also and what sort of impact he feels that the race will have on the season ahead, I guess on the performances of the riders there. And also he spoke a little bit about some of the other riders and what he feels for the season and ahead. So I think we're at an opportune time now to hear what Graham says, particularly with Milan-San Remo and the big classics coming up, and not too far away, the major tours. So let's have a listen to Graham Jones, Part 1. Well, I'm sitting here with Graham Jones, former English professional cyclist, but here at the Tour de Langkawi, just before the start of the final and eighth stage. He is in his last day of this year's tour in his capacity as radio tour caller. Graham, thanks for being on What a Ride. Just firstly, we're one stage away, but it looks like Reinhardt, Jans van Rensburg is going to win this race. How do you see this race compared to other events? Because there hasn't been any of the marquee international names, albeit Andrea Guardini's here, but do you feel the race has been more open than normal, or is there something lacking from it?
I think, I mean, in an ideal world, it would be nice to have one or two more Pro Tour teams here, but the Tour of Langkawi has suffered over the last few years with problems with people getting sick. And unfortunately, I think, last year we had Team Sky here, but I knew from quite a while that Team Sky weren't going to come back this year because of the problems they had. It can take quite a long time for riders to get over a health problem if they have one here, and Team Sky last year had, I think, three or four riders that took months to get over it. So it's always going to be difficult to attract the top teams, and I think particularly at the start of the year, because it can have such a knock-on effect for the rest of the year. As a spectacle, I think the race does make it a little more open, and for me, one of the things about racing in this part of the world is the development of the cycling and the development of other nations. So what it does allow, I think it allows more of the Asian teams to get a ride in the race. This year we've seen the Philippines come back, Indonesia, three Malaysian teams. So I think that is definitely something that's going to improve the cycling.
Yeah, in the summer of cycling in Australia, which has just finished, we had a similar situation where the Tour Down Under didn't have any marquee names, but it had quite a deep sort of field, pretty competitive field. But then, obviously, at that same time, there was the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race, where Mark Cavendish was a marquee name, and then the Herald Sun Tour, Chris Froome was there with Sky, and it was a bit of a debate in Australia about, how important is it to have foreign marquee riders to sell your race. Do you think it's an absolute must, or do you think a race can sell itself just on the standard of the race itself, the competition?
I think in an ideal world it is really a must, but Lankau has had its ups and downs with attracting the big riders, and hopefully that scenario will come back where some of the big names are attracted to come back here. But you know, there's so many other races around the world now that riders and teams are forced to go to. At the same time, we've got Qatar and Oman, and they're of course races run by ASO, the biggest race organiser in the world, and they're under pressure to go there. And these teams are under pressure, if not just with the number of riders they've got in the team that they can put in the races, as much as anything, it's about personnel and team managers that they can send to all these races. So there's always going to be a limited amount of top teams that you can attract.
Just a little word about Hans van Rensburg. I mean, he's not a new rider to the peloton. I mean, he was with the old MTN when it was Continental, and then he went to Shimano Argos World Tour. Then he went back to MTN Quebec, now Dimension Data. How do you feel about his? He's quite an interesting rider, isn't he? I mean, he can climb pretty well. We saw that in the Cameron Highlands stage on stage four, and obviously he's a good sprinter. He told me he sees himself more as a sprinter than a climber. But what do you think his potential is?
I think he's got great potential for, you know, as you say, I mean, it's not the Genting climb that we're used to in this race, but it's a climb that you still have to be a good all-rounder to be able to get up that climb. And the fact that he's been able to get some placings on the flat as well, has enabled him to win the race. And to some extent, I do actually like the fact that the Lankawi has excluded Genting in May and does make the race more sporting, if you like, and allow the all-rounder rather than the climber who just sits in the bunch and waits for Genting. But I think Van Rensburg has got great potential, as has the team. I think the team's a phenomenal story.
Now, just for yourself, for this race, has there been any sort of funny moments in your position as radio tour call? Any little things that have sort of stood out for you? Perhaps humorous, but perhaps not humorous, but certainly left an imprint on your feel for the event.
I can't think of anything particular that's been humorous. It's been fairly straightforward, actually. You do get a real mixture, as much as anything, in the team car driving at the back of the peloton, because a lot of these, particularly in the smaller teams, are not used to riding in a convoy where there is 40 team cars, as much as anything. So some of the driving can leave a little bit to be desired, but, you know, obviously I can't pick out names to say who's at fault. But, sitting behind the bunch, you see something happening all the time, whether it's riders feeding and stuff. But as regards real incidents, no, I think it's been pretty tame this year.
Well, we're talking with Graham Jones, former English professional cyclist. We're going to come back after the break, and we're going to talk to Graham just a little bit about his career, his old days in the 1980s when he was shoulder to shoulder with the likes of Phil Anderson, Robert Miller, Stephen Roach, and how he feels about where cycling's going. Stay tuned and come back to us after the break.
Now the king told the boogeyman, you have to let the record drop. The oil down the desert way has been shaken to the top. The sheik, he drove his Cadillac, he went a-cruising down the beer. The muezzin was just standing on the rainy emigrate.
We've been the boogie star. nation may go, but prejudice will always be there.
Take Satan by the gonads and slings him right off the edge of this planet.
Welcome back to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee, and with our special guest interview, Graham Jones, who we just listened to as Graham spoke about the tour to Langkawi and how he feels the season ahead is going to unfold. You know, it's interesting, Aaron, isn't it, when you speak to someone else about what they feel. I mean, we all have our own ideas about who can do what and everything like that, but a rider like Graham with his experience, and he's, you know, he's worked as a race director, he's been obviously a radio tour caller, he's worked for BBC radio, he's you know, he's done,
he's worked for Eurosport.
There you got that one in, didn't you? And and he's been on What a Ride.
Absolutely.
But I think the only thing he hasn't done is, as he says, is he hasn't been a coach. But I wouldn't mind him coaching me one day. But that we'll leave that for another day. But I think you know, Graham's always an interesting voice to talk about. And one of the things, you know, I guess his calm nature. You know, no wonder he was able to get on with a lot of people and just sort of filter into teams and blend very well, because he has got a pretty calm demeanour, even if he feels that probably he could have asked more of himself and had a bit more mongrel in him. Sure. That might have made a difference in his career. But I think what we'll do now, though, we're going to listen to what Graham Jones says in the second part of our interview, because I might have just alluded to a little bit of what he spoke about. But let's listen to what Graham Jones says about his career, where it began, to what it was like back in the late 70s trying to break into the sport of cycling then. It was completely different to what it is now. And obviously he speaks about how much he feels, how his career went and how or if he could have done better. Here's Graham Jones, part two.
Right now.
Welcome back to What a Ride. I'm sitting here with Graham Jones, former British professional cyclist, but at the moment he's sitting on his last day as this year's Tour de Langkawi as the radio tour caller. Graham, thanks for being on the show. Now, we've known each other for quite a number of years now, and you've helped me a great deal in my book, The Foreign Legion, which was about English-speaking riders who were trying to break through into the professional cycling at a time where there wasn't the big support network. I mean, you really had to pack your bags, and there's a one-way ticket to go over there, and you were one of the members of the Foreign Legion, which were the members of the English-speaking riders who joined the ACBB Amateur Club in Paris and then went on to Peugeot and then to greater things. When you look back on those days in the 80s, how do you feel the sport has changed for a rider? Is it easier now or is it harder because of the internationalisation and greater awareness of the sport?
I mean, cycle racing at the highest level is always going to be hard, and you know, you can't really compare eras in terms of that. It will always be hard no matter what era it is. But I think it's easier in the fact that riders no longer have to up sticks on their own, very much on their own, as we did in our case, in Phil Anderson's case, Robert Miller, myself, up sticks with the bike and, you know, a few pounds or dollars or whatever it was in your pocket, and you basically went and had to make ends meet to stay there. And nowadays a lot of riders you know, getting picked up from their own countries and getting introduced gently into the feeder teams for some of these pro teams. I know the Australians have had their system in Italy for a while, where they brought riders across and done stints there, so they've got used to the whole European feel before they've often made the step up to the pro ranks. So it's not quite as big a jump. And nowadays, particularly from a British point of view, when we did it, you had to up sticks and move to Belgium or Italy or France. But now riders still often live, you know, they have one base. It's so easy to get around Europe now with the number of flights and easy. So that, you know, just getting around, I mean, we spent hours and hours and days in cars sometimes just driving to events, you know, and the logistics of riding, say, a Midi Libre, you drive down there, you leave your car in your town at the start, and then you've got the logistics of getting back to your car afterwards and then going home. So the whole system makes things a lot easier. And of course, I think the biggest thing is that the riders are controlled, looked after more physically, mentally, now with the teams, and they race a lot less. So, you know, the racing still at the highest level is hard, maybe sometimes in a way harder, because people race less and concentrate more on certain periods of the year or certain events. You know, I'm sure from my day, 50% of the field in the Tour de France were already tied before they'd even started the Tour de France from the rest of the season, whereas now 90% of the field has come there to target the Tour, whether it's a stage win or not, you know, so they've been carefully controlled coming into the Tour.
Can you recall the day you arrived at the front door of ACBB at Boulogne-Billancourt in the suburbs of Paris with your bag? I believe it was 1981, correct me?
No, mate, 78 was ACBB with me. I'm going back, I'm the first one.
So you are the pioneer of pioneers.
So along with Paul Shewan, of course, he was a few months earlier than me. But yeah, the first one ACBB that went into the Peugeot ranks. So that was the start of that one. Yeah, I can remember it now. It was January, end of January, snowing. I was on the coach, traveling with another colleague who came across. We were delayed many hours, arrived late at night, and we were met by Claude Escalon at the bus station and taken to our digs. And that was the introduction. Next day, taken to ACBB, and you get your bike and a couple of jerseys, and that's it. You're away, really. Training within the next day, and then I think the next week we were off down to the south of France for the training camp.
You were a very good rider. I mean, and at that time you were even touted as the next best British thing to come. How did you handle that expectation, and what were your sort of your moments? You felt your greatest moments where you. Which was a make or break moment that maybe defined how you went for the rest of your career.
Yeah, I think probably for me, I probably didn't handle it as well as I should have done. I was probably not selfish enough. I'm probably not that little bit of a hunger I should have had it when I was an amateur. But I think once I got to the pro ranks, I think the team that I went to, Peugeot, was had so many stars in it that I got a little bit pushed back, and trying to break through became a little bit of a problem. When I got the odd chance and things, I just tend to, I know it's easy now to say this, but the luck wasn't quite there, you know, Criterium International getting knocked off when I was away on my own and in the mountain stage getting knocked off by the TB motorbike and stuff like that. So it was always the nearly and not quite there. And with cycling, as much as in any sports, it's a confidence thing. And, you know, once you sometimes crack that first win, it can, you know, people can come through, and it gives you that much more confidence to take the chance here and there. Whereas sometimes you might just hesitate and say, I should have gone with that one, and you didn't go, and your teammate did. And, you know, Stephen Roach is a perfect example of the opposite. He came through, obviously had enormous talent, you know, obviously I was never going to be a Tour winner, but he had enormous talent, but he got a fantastic start in his first in his first few months winning Tour of Corsica. It could have been any one of six or seven Peugeot riders in that team that year, and then of course he went on to win Paris-Nice.
Were you a young kid who had the dream to race and to win the Tour like so many cyclists do, or were you coming in with an open mind to see what you could do for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably, you know, there aren't too many people that everybody can dream of the Tour, but maybe realistically probably, you know, that maybe never quite going to win that, but I always realistically dreamt and thought and knew that I was capable of, you know, top 10 finishes in the Tour given the right circumstances and the right backing. I mean, I would have been suited more to today's racing because I wouldn't have been forced to race so much and had some targets. But you're born in the era that you're in, and you get on with it. But yeah, I mean, I have some regrets, but I don't regret doing what I did. I just, you know, like a lot of people, we could have the sliding door syndrome. You know, it's one of those things, and it's just. Could have had that one, if I'd just made that one breakthrough, I think I probably would have had a more different career.
Well, I mean, clearly you love the sport because you've been so much a part of it since. I mean, you've been race director of the Tour de Langkawi before, and you've been television commentator, radio commentator at all the big races. Have you gotten involved in any coaching or mentoring at all?
Coaching is the one side of things I never really went into, or team management. I did a couple of brief events for GB many years ago with the under-23s, but for some reason it wasn't for me, and my background really since has been, as you say, on the TV, the radio side, but also on the organising side, so and the technical side. I've been very much involved in Tour of Langkawi in the early days on the technical side. I've done the routing stuff in Tour de Langkawi in the past, and was for several years director of Tour of Britain and races like that. I've been involved in races all over the world. Still do races now, even for ASO, as an assistant race director, Beijing, Norway, other races like that. So my background has been on that the organisational side rather than the coaching side. But no, I don't think that side was for me, otherwise I probably would have gone into it at an earlier stage. You know, I mean, I've got friends who I race with who have been basically... John Herity, for example, Rafa Condor, his whole career since he stopped racing has been a team manager, and fair credit to him, he obviously loves that side of the sport.
Yeah. Well, Graeme, look, thanks for joining us on the show. What a ride. We could sit here and talk all day, but if we do that, we're going to miss the start and going to be stuck here. We've got a long way to go to Malacca for the end of the tour, but thanks for being on the show, and we'll get you back on later in the year. It's going to be a long and interesting season, I think.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. I think particularly the Tour de France this year, I'd like to see all the big guys up there, Froome, you know, can anybody beat Froome? We'd see whether Quintana progresses, and of course could be Contador's last tour.
Do you have a feel as to who will win, or who you'd like to see win?
I think from a British point of view, it'd be good to see Froome win and keep the momentum going in British cycling, which again, you know, I still find hard to believe that what cycling is in Britain now, from being, you know, a nothing sport to mainstream. So Froome, but I think he's going to face a real battle this year, I think, from Quintana. I think Quintana potentially could have won it last year. Froome was a tired man in that last week of the tour.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think Quintana, probably if you learnt one thing, he's got to make his move earlier in the tour rather than wait till the last mountain as in Alpe d'Huez. But anyway, as I said, we could be talking all day. We started talking on as usual. Graeme, thanks for being on the show, and we'll speak to you later in the year.
Okay, no problem, pleasure.
Even close.
listening to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron S. Lee. And we just heard a little bit of nice music to, well, Graham Jones, the second part of his interview, was a nice segue into that last bit of music there. Well, Aaron, it's been another interesting show, I think. I love this. I love just this chat. We could do it all day. I don't know whether our audience would want us to do it all day, but I love it. And I really feel now, Aaron, that, gee, we're into the season. You know, the real racing starting, and I've got a feel-good buzz about this year. It's going to be, by the end of this year, I think we're going to be talking about so much.
Yeah, well, I agree. It seems like, as you mentioned already, the season is very short, still very relatively young, but so much has happened already, and so much exciting things are underway, and there's a lot of movements on the chessboard, so to speak, and it's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds from here on. You know, great listening to Graham Jones. I was just thinking when we were listening to the second part of that interview, Graham Jones, Graham Watson, Graham Obrey, Graham Brown. Is it something about Graham that first name? Is it does it just kind of lead itself to a great career in cycling?
They're certainly they all certainly have their own personalities. That's for sure. There's a wide mix of personalities there, but all very interesting characters.
Is it too late for us to change our first name to Graham?
Well, I didn't tell you my middle name's Graham.
Is it really?
No, it's not. No, I'm not going to tell you my middle name. It's one of those. I've got two middle names. It's sort of one of those names where you think I must have kicked my mum when I was born or something, you know, because to get and you're not going to get them out of me. Don't worry.
Well, I tell you what, for anyone listening, you know, out there in radio land, please feel free to send us a tweet, send us a Facebook message, email us, let us know. If you happen to know what Rupert's middle names are, please let us know. And you can also tweet and tag Rupert Guinness at Rupert Guinness. That's with RUPERTGUI. NNESS. Please feel free to tag him in that as well. He's not on the Twitter, but he's lurking still.
No comment. I don't tweet anymore. Everyone knows that. So if you do it, there's no replies coming. we'll have to do a special social media edition maybe one time, and that could get sort of we could end up having an argument on air. You never know, Aaron. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Well, no, absolutely. Just as we're talking, just received an email from the Cannondale Pro Team. They're announcing they're going to have multiple options, it looks like, for Milan-San Remo. So it looks like something we'll be able to talk about on the next show for sure. And Simon Clark's name is on there.
Hey, here's a name we forgot to mention earlier. He did very well, didn't he? He had a nice early season win I've forgotten the name of the race, but it was one of those lead-up one-day races in Italy, and that was a great start for Simon. I sent him a message actually just saying how, congratulations, but just, having the change of a team and new hopes and ambitions and, I guess, new faith in Simon, from a new team has given him a bit of calm and an opportunity to sort of break free a bit and spread his wings and have a crack.
Yeah, he did. I believe that was a Grand Prix. It was a 1.1 race or 1.2. I can't remember the name of it myself, but it was a small race, but great to get that confidence in. One of his teammates, who we've talked about a lot too, Patrick Bevan, getting third on the prologue at Paris-Nice.
Oh, yeah, how was that? I mean, that really was an excellent performance. And I guess, us who have been following, Andrew Christie Johnson and the Avanti, Isoway Avanti team, I guess we've seen his progress coming up the ranks, but it's just great to see that performance sort of, it was one race, one time trial, but to see it confirmed like that, I mean, they called the time trial the race of truth. And in that company, you can't be a slouch to finish third in that time trial.
No, absolutely. Of course, he would go on and end up in a crash on stage 5, would suffer a fractured rib that would force him out of stage 6. So he actually wasn't able to finish the race. But just a gutsy performance, and he'll be back. And I'm sure Gent Wevelgem is still on the blocks for him.
Hey, just quick tittle the lid for Sean Lake, by the way, winning back-to-back Oceania titles. Not back-to-back, but the two titles, the time trial and the road race. Not bad for a rower.
No, not bad at all. It looks like maybe the Australian Road Nationals weren't a fluke after all.
No, it's there's something about that, isn't it? It must be what's in their bid-ons or something in that team. They just continue to produce rider after the rider.
Yeah, they really do. And again, what really amazes me most about that program is they keep discovering talent from different sources. We talked just then, Sean Lake being a former rower, Richie Port being a former triathlete, Nathan Haas and those guys being former mountain bikers. I mean, I like that element of finding that undiscovered jewel from another sport. Obviously, they're closely related, but they're not getting it from the traditional pathways, are they?
No, exactly. Hey, what do you think Andrew Christian Johnson could do with two old hacks? And what do you think he could do with us? Do you reckon, how far down the road do you think we could stay away, if we could get away? We'd probably get dropped to the neutralized zone.
Well, yeah, I don't even know I'd make it to the neutral zone if there was a bar or a pub en route to the neutral. I may not actually make it to the start, but if you dangle a nice tall pint of, you know, tall cold pint of Guinness at the finish line, I'd sure do my best to get there, buddy. I sure would.
I don't doubt you somehow, Aaron. Just lastly, what's up for you, mate? You know, I know you've got we've all got St. Patrick's Day festivities to get through. But what about in the next week or two? And you know, what are your movements?
Well, St. Patrick's Day is such a fantastic holiday, as we mentioned earlier in the show. I don't know. I'm not looking much past that. I just want to get past St. Patrick's Day, make sure that I survive intact, and kind of take it from there. But there's some great racing coming up. Some races tentatively. We're looking at the Joe Martin race.
Mm-hmm.
Stage race in Fayetteville, and obviously going to look at maybe even the Sonny King race next weekend in Alabama. It's a two-day criterium, and then some America's Tour races, and then potentially I've got some emails I've got to get back to, potentially Turkey, and then back to Korea.
How you like with the Joe Martin race? Be interesting to see how the United Healthcare team do there. They raced really well at Langkawi. They had a good Aussie campaign with the Herald Sun Tour as well. You know, it's a good team there. I'm looking forward to seeing how they go there. I mean, obviously their big plans are for Tour of California, but you know, Joe Martin race will be their first race since Langkawi, and I guess their other team was also racing in Asia, wasn't it? Either way, they're all back in the States now, ready to I guess make best of what they can on the US circuit.
Well, I'll be looking forward to seeing UHC, because I always like catching up with their DS, who I believe we may have an interview with next week.
Yes, good old Hendrik Radant. He is a classic. He is a classic of he's a classic rider who loved his classics. He still loves classics, and we had a good chat with him there. And as you know, Aaron, you have a chat with Hendrik. It's always a good chat, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite times is actually going back to Langkawi, sharing a cab into the Kuala Lumpur, into the entertainment district. So I have probably some stories I can talk about, and a few that I probably cannot.
Okay, look, we'll look forward to hearing some of those. We'll talk about that next on the next episode of What a Ride. Aaron, one last word, mate. We've got to wrap things up, because I think my Guinness is just being, I think they're just rolling the kegs into place for the first tap of the keg and the first Guinness to come glowingly out of the tap.
No, listen, just go enjoy, buddy. Be safe. Have a great holiday today. And for all those out there, just remember to keep it rubber side down, and that a meter matters.
Exactly. Couldn't say it better. And happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody around the world. And while everyone's, a lot of people are having some festivity there, just stay safe, as Aaron said. And if you're going somewhere, if you're going to have a drink, just, you know, if you don't need to drive, don't drive. Just take a taxi or walk or public transport. Avoid any mishaps that you can. Stay safe.
Or Uber.
Okay. Obviously, Aaron S. Lee has an Uber link there. I was trying to be serious there, Aaron. That was my. Anyway, everybody out there, what a ride land. Thanks for listening to myself, Rupert Guinness, and Aaron S. Lee. Have a great week and stay safe. A meter matters.
angels, dancing in the deepest oceans, to sing in the water, you're just like a dream, just like a dream. Lift me into shape. I must have been asleep for days. Her moving lips to breathe her name. I opened up my eyes and found myself alone, alone, alone above a raging sea. I stole the only girl I loved, drowned her deep inside of me. You knew, soft and lonely. Lost and lonely, you just like heaven.